Dick Cheney.
The read we get on the people of Iraq is there's no question but what they want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and they will welcome as liberators the United States when we come to do that.
In April 2003, American and coalition forces ousted Saddam Hussein and set out to create a new, free society in Iraq. And to do so, they were going to use the very same technique they had used in Russia, shock therapy.
USA, good, freedom, USA.
Thank you. So can I
yes, good.
The head of the Provisional Authority, Paul Bremer, arrived in Iraq with a plan drawn up by a radical group of economists that was even more extreme and more utopian than had been tried in Russia. The people were to be liberated from all forms of state control. And Bremer immediately set about sacking all members of the Ba'ath Party who had run Iraqi society. It was a dramatic revolutionary move. Overnight, the Americans destroyed the civic structure of Iraqi society. But instead of trying to create new institutions, Bremer's plan then set out to engineer the perfect market economy, which the Americans believed would then automatically create a new democracy. All industries and public services were to be privatized immediately. The country would then be thrown open to international corporations, who in return for investing could take 100% of their profits out of the country untaxed. Only one of Saddam Hussein's laws remained, the one that restricted trade unions. Out of this was supposed to come spontaneous order. What resulted was chaos.
U.S. soldier in Iraq.
There's a definite disconnect between what needs to happen and what's actually happening. We need to get these people food, water, housing, and a government fast. Here, on the lowest level of military hierarchy, I don't see it happening. I see nothing of this happening. And I'm sure there are plans being made, papers drafted, whatnot. But these people don't see that, and I don't see it, and that's what makes them angry, and that's what makes them want to attack us.
What are you trying to do?
Trying to change these people's way of, I don't know.
What also resulted was corruption on a huge scale. More than $350 billion has been sent to Iraq for reconstruction. Audits completed so far show that over 10% of the money has disappeared or been siphoned off by American corporations in corrupt overpricing. Then the Americans announced that the new Iraqi constitution would be written by a governing council whose members would not be elected, but would be chosen by the Americans themselves. The most senior figure in the Shiite community, Ayatollah Sistani, then issued a series of fatwas that stated that this was not real democracy. Sistani quoted the principles behind the French Revolution, the idea of a social contract between the people and their rulers. What the Americans are imposing, he said, is a limited, narrow form of democracy that ignores this basic principle. He called on his followers to protest, and he warned that unless the Americans allowed real democracy, the very opposite would rise up to fill its place, an anti-democratic Islamism.
We want to express about our opinion. It's the democracy in Britain, in Australia.
We've never had democracy before, this man says. Don't we deserve it?
But Sistani was ignored, and the insurgency began, led by many of the men the Americans had sacked. What was happening in Iraq was the strange logic of the attempt to impose the idea of negative liberty by revolutionary means. Just as in Russia, this narrow conception of freedom was unable to deal with the complexities of a society composed not just of individuals, but of powerful groups driven by conflicting ideas of nationalism and Islamism. And in the face of that failure, the Americans began to turn to violence and torture to try and enforce their kind of freedom. And at the same time, the Islamists turned to killing and assassination in order to enforce their revolutionary vision of an Islamist state. Israel! 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 and the revolutionary attempt to create negative liberty abroad was also transforming freedoms in Britain itself.
Your democratically elected governments continuously perpetuate atrocities against my people all over the world, and your support of them makes you directly responsible.
In July 2005, Islamist terrorists, who claimed to be responding to Britain's policy in Afghanistan and Iraq, bombed London. Blair's response was to push forward dramatic changes to the law. He saw it as an opportunity to reinforce in a much wider way the specific ideas of negative liberty. Blair believed that the criminal justice system protected the accused at the expense of the innocent law-abiding individual, and that should be changed.
The fundamental dilemma is this. How do we reconcile liberty with security in this new world? When a crime goes unpunished, that is a breach of the victim's liberty and human rights. When we can't deport foreign nationals, even when inciting violence, this country is at risk. Let liberty at last stand up for the law-abiding citizen in this country.
What Blair was proposing was that from antisocial behaviour through to terrorism, individuals could be detained or punished on far less evidence than before, or even on the suspicion that they might commit a crime in the future. There has been enormous opposition to this from the legal profession. They argue that it opens the way to the arbitrary use of power by governments. Politicians can now decide who is a normal law-abiding citizen and who is the individual whose ideas might lead to dangerous crimes in the future and should be locked up with little or no evidence. Yet again, negative liberty has transformed itself into what Berlin had warned against. It's become a version of its opposite, positive liberty. Our political leaders have the power to decide what is the right kind of free individual and to punish those who do not conform to that ideal. There is one thing that makes our freedom today different from positive liberty. Positive liberty is driven by a vision that freedom is for something. The freedom to do or to become something new, out of which a better world will come. Negative liberty has no such vision. It isn't for anything. At its heart, it has no purpose other than to keep us free from unnecessary constraint or harm. And in using force to create a world based on negative liberty, the democratic revolutionaries have actually led millions of people abroad into a world without purpose or meaning. This idea of freedom is still portrayed by many politicians and influential commentators as a universal absolute. They assume it is only a matter of time before it spreads throughout the world. But this may not be true. As this series has shown, the idea of freedom that we live with today is a narrow and limiting one that was born out of a specific and dangerous time, the Cold War. It may have had meaning and purpose then as an alternative to communist tyranny, but now it's become a dangerous trap. Our government relies on a simplistic economic model of human beings that allows inequality to grow and offers nothing positive in the face of the reactionary forces they have helped to awake around the world. If we ever want to escape from this limited worldview, we will have to rediscover the progressive, positive ideas of freedom and realise that Isaiah Berlin was wrong. Not all attempts to change the world for the better lead to tyranny.
You've
You've just been listening to the final installment of the three-part documentary, The Trap, What Happened to Our Dream of Freedom, written and directed by Adam Curtis and adapted for radio by me. I hope you enjoyed it. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
One of the most eloquent and uncompromising voices against war was that of Eugene Debs. At first an organizer of railroad workers, later a leader of the Socialist Party. On June 18, 1918, he spoke in Canton, Ohio, in defiance of the Espionage Act, which made it a crime to say anything that would obstruct recruitment into the armed forces. He was arrested, found guilty, and his sentence of 10 years was upheld by a unanimous Supreme Court. Here's the speech that led to his arrest.
Sam Johnson declared that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. He must have had the Wall Street gentry in mind. Or at least their prototypes. For in every age it has been the tyrant, the oppressor, and the exploiter who has wrapped himself in the cloak of patriotism or religion or both to deceive and overawe the people. Every solitary one of these aristocratic conspirators and would-be murderers claims to be an arch-patriot. Every one of them insists that the war is being waged to make the world safe for democracy. What humbug! What rot! What false pretense! These autocrats, these tyrants, these red-handed robbers and murderers, the patriots. Well, the men who have the courage to stand face to face with them, speak the truth, and fight for their exploited victims, they are the disloyalists and the traitors. If this be true, I want to take my side by side with the traitors in this fight. Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder. In the Middle Ages, when the feudal lords who inhabited the castles whose towers may still be seen along the Rhine concluded to enlarge their domains, to increase their power, their prestige, and their wealth, they declared war upon one another. But they themselves did not go to war any more than the modern feudal lords, the barons of Wall Street, go to war. The feudal barons of the Middle Ages, the economic predecessors of the capitalists of our day, declared all wars. And their miserable serfs fought all the battles. The poor, ignorant serfs had been taught to revere their masters, to believe that when their masters declared war upon one another, it was their patriotic duty to fall upon one another and to cut one another's throats for the profit and glory of the lords and barons who held them in contempt. And that is war, in a nutshell. The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles. The master class has had all to gain and nothing to lose, while the subject class has had nothing to gain and all to lose. Especially their lives. They've always taught and trained you to believe it to be your patriotic duty to go to war and have yourselves slaughtered at their command. But in all the history of the world, you, the people, have never had a voice in declaring war. And strange as it certainly appears, no war by any nation in any age has ever been declared by the people. Yours not to reason why. Yours but to do and die. That is their motto, and we object on the part of the awakening workers of this nation. If war is right, let it be declared by the people. You who have your lives to lose, you certainly, above all others, have the right to decide the momentous issue of war and peace.
The 1918 Speech of Eugene Debs, recreated by Brian Jones, part of a selection of readings from Voices of the People's History of the United States, Historical Figures in Their Own Words, compiled by Howard Zinn and Anthony Arnoff. And now the conclusion of the final chapter in John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, Chapter 18, Breaking Out of the Trap. Where we left off last week, he wrote, quote, "We are to be made and kept as nervous, whining adolescents. This is a job best begun and ended while we are little children, hence the kind of schools we have. A governor put on our growth, through which we are denied the understanding needed to escape childhood. Don't blame schools. Schools only follow orders." And so we pick up, as Gatto writes, "Not far to go now. Here is my recipe for empty children. If you want to cook whole children, as I suspect we all do, just contradict these stages in the formula. 1. Remove children from the business of the world until time has passed for them to learn how to self-teach. 2. Age grade them so the past and future are both muted and become irrelevant. 3. Take all religion out of their lives except the hidden civil religion of appetite and positive-negative reinforcement schedules. 4. Remove all significant functions from home and family life except its role as dormitory and casual companionship. Make parents unpaid agents of the state. Recruit them into partnerships to monitor the conformity of children to an official agenda. 5. Keep children under surveillance every minute from dawn to dusk. Give no private space or time. Fill time with collective activities. Record behavior quantitatively. 6. Addict the young to machinery and electronic displays. Teach that these are desirable to recreation and learning, both. Use designed games and commercial entertainment to teach pre-planned habits, attitudes, and language usage. 8. Pair the selling of merchandise with attractive females in their prime childbearing years so that the valences of lovemaking and mothering can be transferred intact into the goods vended. 9. Remove as much private ritual as possible from young lives, such as the rituals of food preparation and family dining. 10. Keep both parents employed with the business of strangers. Discourage independent livelihoods with low startup costs. Make labor for others and outside obligations first priority, self-development second. 11. Grade, evaluate, and assess children constantly and publicly. Begin early. Make sure everyone knows his or her rank. 12. Honor the highly graded. Keep grading and real-world accomplishment as strictly separate as possible so that a false meritocracy, dependent on the support of authority to continue, is created. Push the most independent kids to the margin. Do not tolerate real argument. 13. Forbid the efficient transmission of useful knowledge, such as how to build a house, repair a car, or make a dress. 14. Reward dependency in many forms. Call it teamwork. 15. Establish visually degraded group environments called schools and arrange mass movements through these environments at regular intervals. Encourage a level of fluctuating noise, a periodic negative reinforcement, so that concentration, habits of civil discourse, and intellectual investigation are gradually extinguished from the behavioral repertoire." And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Until his death in an accident a few years ago, the president of Macmillan Publishing Company, one of the largest school material suppliers in the world, was a third grade dropout. Actually, like other children in his Russian village, he received 7 years of schooling. He was also president, of Berlitz language schools. And so we arrive at the end of our journey together. You have seen the trap conceived, the trap built, the trap sprung, and its quarry turning in panic within until the bright light of living spirit goes dull behind its eyes and grows indifferent to its banal fate in a comprehensively planned society and economy without any hope of escape. You have watched the trap grow like Arch Obler's demonic chicken heart, maintained by an army of behaviorally adjusted functionaries, reproducing its own mechanistic encoding in the lives of school children. You have watched the listless creatures caught in the trap, pressing a bar to get their food while they await instructions to their final meaningless destiny. How the trap was conceived hardly makes much difference at this point, except to warn us that we are not dealing with any ordinary mistake. This trap was intended to be as it is. It is a work of great human genius. Mass schooling cannot be altered or reformed because any palliative from its killing religion will only be short-lived as long as the massification machinery it represents remains in place. That's why all the well-publicized, this-time-we-have-it-right alternatives to factory schooling fizzle out a decade after launch, most sooner. Nothing in human history gives us any reason to be optimistic that powerful social machinery, through its very existence, doesn't lead to gross forms of oppression. If engines of mass control exist, the wrong hands will find the switches sooner or later. That's why standing armies, like the enormous one we now maintain, are an invitation to serfdom. They will always, sooner or later, go domestic. The more rationally engineered the machinery, the more certain its eventual corruption. That's a bitter pill rationalists still haven't learned to swallow. We are, I think, at one of those great points of choice in the human record where society gets to select from among widely divergent futures. It's customary to say there will be no turning back from our choice, but that is wrong. It would be more accurate to say that we will not be able to turn back from our next choice without a great and dreadful grief. It's best to heed the Amish counsel not to jump until you know where you're going to land. Not jumping at this moment in time means rejecting further centralization of children in government schooling. It means rejecting every attempt to nationalize the religious enterprise of institutional schooling. If centralizers prevail, the connection between schooling and work will become total. If decentralizers prevail, it will be diffuse, irregular, and, for many kinds of work, as utterly insignificant as it should be. Experts have consistently misdiagnosed and misdefined the problem of schooling. The problem is not that children don't learn to read, write, and do arithmetic well. The problem is that kids hardly learn at all from the way schools insist on teaching. Schools desperately need a vision of their own purpose. It was never factually true that all young people learn to read or do arithmetic by being taught these things, though for many decades that has been the masquerade. When children are stripped of a primary experience base, as confinement schooling must do to justify its existence, the natural sequence of learning is destroyed, a sequence which puts experience first. Only much later, after a long bath in experience, does the thin gruel of abstraction mean very much. We haven't forgotten this. There is just no profit in remembering it for the businesses and people who make their bread and butter from monopoly schooling. The relentless rationalization of the school world has left the modern student a prisoner of low-grade vocational activities. He lives in a disenchanted world without meaning. Our cultural dilemma here in the United States has little to do with children who don't read, but lies instead in finding ways to restore meaning and purpose to modern life. Any system of values that accepts the transformation of the world into machinery and the construction of pens for the young called schools necessarily rejects this search for meaning. Schools at present are the occupation of children. Children have become employees, pensioners of the government at an early age. But government jobs are frequently not really jobs at all. That certainly is the case in the matter of being a school child. There is nothing or very little to do in school, but one thing is demanded, that children must attend, condemned to hours of desperation, pretending to do a job that doesn't exist. At the end of the day, tired, fed up, full of aggression, their families feel the accumulated tedium of their pinched lives. Government jobs for children have broken the spirit of our people. They don't know their own history, nor would they care to. In a short time, such a system becomes addictive. Even when efforts are made to find real work for children to do, they often drift back to meaningless busy work. Anyone who has ever tried to lead students into generating lines of meaning in their own lives will have felt the resistance, the hostility even, to which broken children fight to be left alone. They prefer the illness they have become accustomed to. As the school day and year enlarge, students may be seen as people forbidden to leave their offices, as people hemmed in by an invisible fence, complaining but timid. Schools thus consume most of the people they incarcerate. School curricula are like unwholesome economies. They don't deal in basic industries of mind, but instead try to be popular, dealing in the light stuff in an effort to hold down rebellion. That's why we can't read Paine's Common Sense anymore, often can't read at all. Only one person in every 16, I'm told, reads more than one book a year after graduation from high school. Kids and teachers live day by day. That's all you can do when you have a runaway inflation of expectations fueled by false promissory notes on the future issued by teachers and television and other mythmakers in our culture. The inflationary economy of mass schooling, with its A's and gold stars and handshakes and trophies tied to nothing real, you cease to plan. You're just happy to make it to the weekend. Once the inflation of dishonesty is perceived, the curriculum can only be imposed by intimidation, by a dissipy of bells and horns, by confusion. With inflation of the school variety, a gun is held to your head by the state, demanding you acknowledge that school time is valuable. Otherwise, everyone would leave except the teachers who are being paid. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. What to do? Take Melville's insight, "I would prefer not to," from Bartleby the Scrivener, and make it your own watchword. Read Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Ilyich for a shock of inspiration about what really matters. Breaking the hold of fear on your life is the necessary first step. If you can keep your kid out of any part of the school sequence at all, keep him or her out of kindergarten, then first, second, and maybe third grade. Homeschool them at least that far through the zone where most of the damage is done. If you can manage that, they'll be okay. Don't let a world of funny animals, dancing alphabet letters, pastel colors, and treachy music suffocate your little boy or girl's consciousness at exactly the moment when big questions about the world beckon. Funny animals were invented by North German social engineers. They knew something important about fantasy and social engineering that you should teach yourself. Your four-year-old wants to play? Let him help you cook dinner for real. Fix the toilet, clean the house, build a wall. Give her a map, a mirror, a wristwatch. Let her chart the world in which she really lives. You'll be able to tell from the joy she displays that becoming strong and useful is the best play of all. Pure games are okay, too, but not day in, day out, not a prison of games. There isn't a single formula for breaking out of the trap, only a general one you tailor to your own specifications. No two escape routes are exactly alike. Stanley, my absentee pupil, found one. Two magnificent American teenagers, Tara Lipinski and Michelle Kwan, who enchanted the world with a display of physical artistry and mental discipline on ice skates in the Olympic Games in Japan, found another. Neither went to school, and both gained wealth and prominence for their accomplishments. For me, they show again what stories might be written out of ordinary lives if our time to learn wasn't so lavishly wasted. Are your children less than these? At least 9 major assumptions about the importance of government schooling must be acknowledged as false before you can get beyond the fog of ideology into the clear air of education. Here they are. 1. Universal government schooling is the essential force for social cohesion. There is no other way. A heavily bureaucratized public order is our defense against chaos and anarchy. Right, and if you don't wipe your bum properly, the toilet monster will rise out of the bowl and get you. 2. The socialization of children in age-graded groups monitored by state agents is essential to learn to get along with others in a pluralistic society. The actual truth is that the rigid compartmentalizations of schooling teach a crippling form of social relation. Wait passively until you are told what to do. Never judge your own work or confer with associates. Have contempt for those younger than yourself and fear of those older. Behave according to the meaning assigned your class label. These are the rules of a nut house. No wonder kids cry and become fretful after first grade. 3. Children from different backgrounds and from families with different beliefs must be mixed together. The unexamined inference here is that in this fashion, they enlarge their understanding, but the actual management of classrooms everywhere makes only the most superficial obeisance to human difference. From the first, a radical turn toward some unitarian golden mean is taken, along the way of which different backgrounds and different beliefs are subtly but steadily discredited. 5. The certified expertise of official school teachers is superior in its knowledge of children to the accomplishments of laypeople, including parents. Protecting children from the uncertified is a compelling public concern. Actually, the enforced long-term segregation of children from the working world does some great damage. And the general body of men and women certified by the state as fit to teach is nearly the least fit occupational body in the entire economy if college performance is the standard. 5. Coercion in the name of education is a valid use of state power, compelling assemblies of children into specified groupings for prescribed intervals and sequences with appointed overseers does not interfere with academic learning. Were you born yesterday? Plato said, nothing of value to the individual happens by coercion. 6. Children will inevitably grow apart from their parents in belief, and this process must be encouraged by diluting parental influence and disabusing children of the idea that their parents are sovereign in mind or morality. That prescription alone has been enough to cripple the American family. The effects of forced disloyalty on family are hideously destructive, removing the only certain support the growing spirit has to refer to. In place of family, the school offers phantoms like ambition, advancement, and fun, nightmare harbingers of the hollow life ahead. 7. An overriding concern of schooling is to protect children from bad parents. No wonder G. Stanley Hall, the father of school administration, invited Sigmund Freud to the United States in 1909. It was urgent business to establish a, quote, scientific basis upon which to justify the anti-family stance of state schooling and the programmatic state in general. 8. It is not appropriate for any family to unduly concern itself with the education of its own children, although it is appropriate to sacrifice for the general education of everyone in the hands of state experts. This is the standard formula for all forms of socialism and the universal foundation of utopian promises, says Gatto. I disagree with that statement. Mikhail Bakunin, in his book Stateless Socialism, Anarchy, defined socialism as, quote, "Every human being should have the material and moral means to develop all his humanity, to organize society in such a manner that every individual man or woman should find upon entering life approximately equal means for the development of his or her diverse faculties and their utilization in his or her work, and to organize such a society that rendering impossible the exploitation of anyone's labor will enable every individual to enjoy the social wealth which in reality is produced only by collective labor, but to enjoy it only insofar as he contributes directly toward the creation of that wealth," close quote. And continuing with Gatto, point 9. The last of the major assumptions, he says, must be challenged, that the state is the proper parent and has predominant responsibility for training morals and beliefs. This is the parens patriae doctrine of Louis XIV, King of France, a tale unsuited to a republic. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Let me end this book, my testament, with a warning. Only the fresh air from millions upon millions of freely made choices will create the educational climate we need to realize a better destiny. No team of experts can possibly possess the wisdom to impose a successful solution to the problem inherent in a philosophy of centralized social management. Solutions that endure are always local, always personal. Universal prescriptions are the problem of modern schooling. Academic research, which pursues the will-o'-the-wisp of average children and average stages of development, makes for destructive social policy. It is a sea anchor dragging against advancement, creating the problems it begs for money to solve. But here is a warning. Should we ever agree to honor the singularity of children which forced schooling contravenes, if we ever agree to set the minds of children free, we should understand that they would make a world that would create and recreate itself exponentially, a world complex beyond the power of any group of managers to manage. Such free beings would have to be self-managing, and the future would never again be easily predictable. Here might be a first step toward such a great leap forward for human beings. Not a comprehensive formula, remember, but a first step. If we closed all government schools, made free libraries universal, encouraged public discussion groups everywhere, sponsored apprenticeships for every young person who wanted one, let any person or group who asked to open a school do so without government oversight, paid parents, if we have to pay anyone, to school their kids at home using the money we currently spent to confine them in school factories, and launched a national crash program in family revival and local economies, Amish and Mondragon style, the American school nightmare would recede. That isn't going to happen. I know. The next best thing, then, is to deconstruct forced schooling, minimizing its school aspect, indoctrination, and maximizing its potential to educate through access to tools, models, and mentors. To go down this path requires the courage to challenge deeply rooted assumptions. We need to kill the poison plant we created. School reform is not enough. The notion of schooling itself must be challenged. Do this as an individual if your group won't go along. Here is a preliminary list of strategies to change the schools we have. I intend to develop the theme of change further in a future book, The Guerrilla Curriculum, How to Get an Education in Spite of School. But I'm out of time and breath, so the brief agenda which follows will have to suffice for the moment. As you read my ideas, maintain a lively awareness of the implicit irony that to impose them as a counter-system would require as dictatorial a central management like the current dismal reality. The trick, then, is not to impose them. My own belief, based on long experience, is that people, given a degree of choice, arrive without coercion at arrangements somewhat like these, and even improve upon them with ideas beyond my own imagination to conceive, such as the genius of liberty. Dismiss the army of reading and arithmetic specialists and the commercial empire they represent. Allow all contracts with colleges, publishers, consultants, and material suppliers in these areas to lapse. Reading and arithmetic are easy things to learn, although nearly impossible to teach. By the use of common sense and proven methods that don't cost much, we can solve a problem which is artificially induced and wholly imaginary. Take the profit out of these things, and the disease will cure itself. Let no school exceed a few hundred in size. Even that's far too big. And make them local. And all unnecessary transportation of students at once. Transportation is what the British used to do with hardened criminals. We don't need it. We need neighborhood schools. Time to shut the school factories, profitable to the building and maintenance industries and to bus companies, but disaster for children. Neighborhoods need their own children and vice versa. It's a reciprocating good, providing surprising service to both. The factory school doesn't work anywhere, not in Harlem and not in Hollywood Hills either. Education is always individualized, and individualization requires absolute trust and split-second flexibility. This should save taxpayers a bundle, too. Make everybody teach. Don't let anybody get paid for schooling kids without actually spending time with them. The industrial model, with pyramidal management and plenty of horizontal feather-bedding niches, is based on ignorance of how things get done, or indifference to results. The administrative racket that gave New York City more administrators than all the nations of Europe combined in 1991 has got to die. It wastes billions, demoralizes teachers, parents, and students, and corrupts the common enterprise. Measure performance with individualized instruments. Standardized tests, like schools themselves, have lost their moral legitimacy. They correlate with nothing of human value, and their very existence perverts curriculum into a preparation for these extravagant rituals. Indeed, all paper and pencil tests are a waste of time, useless as predictors of anything important unless the competition is rigged. As a casual guide, they are probably harmless, but as a sorting tool, they are corrupt and deceitful. A test of whether you can drive is driving. Performance testing is where genuine evaluation will always be found. There surely can't be a normal parent on earth who doesn't judge his or her child's progress by performance. Shut down district school boards. Families need control over the professionals in their lives. Decentralize schooling down to the neighborhood school building level, each school with its own citizen managing board. School corruption, like the national school milk price rigging scandal of the 1990s, will cease when the temptations of bulk purchasing, job giveaways, and remote decision making are ended. Install permanent parent facilities in every school with appropriate equipment to allow parent partnerships with their own kids and others. Frequently take kids out of school to work with their own parents. School policies must deliberately aim to strengthen families. Restore the primary experience base we stole from childhood by a slavish adherence to the utopian school diet of steady abstraction, or an equally slavish adherence to play as the exclusive obligation of children. define primary experience as the essential core of early education, secondary data processing a supplement of substantial importance. Be sure the concepts of work, duty, obligation, loyalty, and service are strong components of the mix. Let them stand shoulder to shoulder with fun. Let children engage in real tasks as Amish children do, not synthetic games and simulations that set them up for commercial variants of more of the same for the rest of their lives. Recognize that total schooling is psychologically and procedurally unsound, wasteful and horrendously expensive. Give children some private time and space, some choice of subjects, methods, and associations, and freedom from constant surveillance. A strong element of volition, of choice, of anti-compulsion is essential to education. That doesn't mean granting a license to do anything. Anyway, whatever is chosen as curriculum, the vital assistance that old can grant young is to demand that personal second or third best will not do. The favor you can bestow on your children is to show by your own example that hard, painstaking work is the toll an independent spirit charges itself for self-respect. Our colleges work somewhat better than our other schools because they understand this better. Admit there is no one right way to grow up successfully. One system schooling has had a century and a half to prove itself. It is a ghastly failure. Children need the widest possible range of roads in order to find the right one to accommodate themselves. The premise upon which mass compulsion schooling is based is dead wrong. It tries to shoehorn every style, culture, and personality into one ugly boot that fits nobody. Tax credits, vouchers, and other more sophisticated means are necessary to encourage a diverse mix of different school logics of growing up. Only sharp competition can reform the present mess. This needs to be an overriding goal of public policy. Neither national nor state government oversight is necessary to make a voucher tax credit plan work. A modicum of local control, a disclosure law with teeth, and a policy of client satisfaction, or else, is all the citizen protection needed. It works for supermarkets and doctors. It will work for schools, too, without national testing. Teach children to think dialectically so they can challenge the hidden assumptions of the world around them, including school assumptions, so they can eventually generate much of their own personal curriculum and oversight. But teach them, too, that dialectical thinking is unsuited to many important things like love and family. Dialectical analysis is radically inappropriate outside its purview. Arrange much of schooling around complex themes instead of subjects. Subjects have a real value, too, but subject study as an exclusive diet was a Prussian secret weapon to produce social stratification. Substantial amounts of interdisciplinary work are needed as a corrective. Force the school structure to provide flex time, flex space, flex sequencing, and flex content so that every study can be personalized to fit the whole range of individual styles and performance. Break the teacher certification monopoly so anyone with something valuable to teach can teach it. Nothing is more important than this. Our form of schooling has turned us into dependent, emotionally needy, excessively childish people who wait for a teacher to tell them what to do. Our national dilemma is that too many of us are now homeless and mindless in the deepest sense, at the mercy of strangers. The beginning of answers will come only when people force government to return educational choice to everyone. But choice is meaningless without an absolute right to have progress monitored locally, too, not by an agency of the central government. Solzhenitsyn was right. The American founding documents didn't mention school, because the authors foresaw the path school would inevitably set us upon and rejected it. The best way to start offering some choice immediately is to give each public school the independence that private schools have. De-systematize them. Grant each private, parochial, and homeschool equal access to public funds through vouchers administered as a loan program, along with tax credits. In time, the need for even this would diminish, but my warning stands. If these keys to choice are tied to intrusive government oversight, as some would argue they must be, they will only hasten the end of the American libertarian experiment. Vouchers are only a transition to what is really called for, an economy of independent livelihoods, a resurrection of principles over pragmatism, and the restoration of the private obligation self-imposed to provide a living wage to all who work for you. Schools can never deal with really important things. Only education can teach us that quests don't always work, that even worthy lives most often end in tragedy, that money can't prevent this, that failure is a regular part of the human condition, that you will never understand evil, that serious pursuits are almost always lonely, that you can't negotiate love, that money can't buy much that really matters, that happiness is free. A 25-year-old school dropout walked the length of the planet without help. A 17-year-old school dropout worked a 26-foot sailboat all by herself around the girdle of the globe. What else does it take to realize the horrifying limitations we've inflicted on our children? School is a liar's world. Let us be done with it. And that, at long last, is the conclusion of Chapter 18 and of the book, The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. You can download this entire book online for free from his website, johntaylorgatto.com.
In the 1930s, Sylvia Woods was a pioneer in the struggle of African-American trade unionists. Here she describes her earliest experiences speaking out against racism.
When I was maybe 10 years old, I changed schools. On the way to school, I had to go through a park that was for white people only. There were swings in this park, and I so much wanted sometimes just to stop and swing a little while. But we couldn't, because we were black. I would walk through this park to my school, where there weren't any swings. Every morning, all the kids would line up according to classrooms, and we would have prayers and sing the Star Spangled Banner. One day, I decided I wasn't going to sing the Star Spangled Banner. I just stood there every morning, and I didn't sing it. One of the teachers noticed that I wasn't doing it. So she very quietly called me over and asked me why I didn't sing the Star Spangled Banner. I said I just didn't feel like singing it. So she said, well, then you have to go into the principal and explain that to him. All of the children in the school take part, and you've got to do so too. Okay. I went into the principal, and he asked me why I wasn't singing the Star Spangled Banner. I told him, because it says the land of the free and the home of the brave, and this is not the land of the free. I don't know who's brave, but I'm not going to sing it anymore. Then he said, why, you've been singing it all the time, haven't you? How come you want to stop now? And I told him about coming through the park, and if I could not swing on those swings in the park, and if I couldn't sit in the park, and I could only walk in Shakespeare Park, then it couldn't be the land of the free. Who's free? He didn't say anything. Then he said, well, you could pledge your allegiance to your flag. I said, it's not my flag. The flag is with freedom. If the land is free and the flag is mine, then how come I can't do like the white kids do?
The words of Sylvia Woods, read by Leslie Silva. Thank you for listening once again to another episode of Unwelcome Guests. This and all previous episodes of the show are online and can be downloaded as MP3 files at unwelcomeguests.org. You can also send an email through the website. This following announcement is a call for support and solidarity for local listeners in the Finger Lakes. This Wednesday, August 22nd, five of our friends and neighbors will be appearing in court as a result of their arrests 2 weeks ago in the Bath District Office of U.S. Congressmember Randy Kuhl, Republican, an ardent and unrelenting supporter of George Bush and the so-called War on Terror. Danny Burns, Mark Carver, Chris Tate, Ellen Grady, and Todd Sadler were all arrested when they brought 3,000 petitions asking Kuhl to make a public declaration that he would not vote for any additional funding for the war in Iraq. They waited in vain all day for Kuhl and were arrested for criminal trespass when they refused to leave at the end of the day. This Wednesday, that's August 22nd, the activists will meet with the Bath District Attorney. They have asked for our support as they grapple with the judicial system and attempt to put the war on Iraq on trial. There will be a vigil held at 4 p.m. in front of the Bath Administration Building at 110 Liberty Street. For more information, contact Peter DeMott. That's at Area 607-277-6932, 277-6932, or email degr@lightlink.com, degr@lightlink.com. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Once again, thank you so much for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by